Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. In his book, The Meaning of the Body, Mark Johnson looks to studies of scientists and scholars in a variety of fields, particularly those during the last 30 years. And he looks at scholarship that was adumbrated early in the 20th century by William James and John Dewey. James and Dewey were American pragmatists, a field now rather poorly understood, and also rather easily misunderstood and misrepresented. To complement Johnson, I think we ought to actually trace this study of pragmatism back to Charles Sanders Peirce, the father of pragmatism, who lived in the late 19th, early 20th century, and is perhaps the preeminent American philosopher. And thinking about that, we might even go back to Friedrich Schiller, whose book on the aesthetic education of man, which was published in 1793, was a powerful influence to Charles Sanders Peirce as a teenager. I think that when Peirce read Schiller, it created the intellectual foundation that would carry him through much of his very long and enormously productive work throughout his life. Now, in Mark Johnson's study of meaning-making in art, he made the following statement. The idea that only words have meaning ignores vast stretches on the landscape of human meaning-making. Now, for students of religion, I think this is a really important point and needs to be taken quite seriously. The study of religion is an amazingly word-bound, very heady, very intellectual kind of endeavor in the academy. And it really restricts much of its, almost all of its meaning to that which is based in words. So Johnson's statement is a significant challenge, and that is that if we restrict meaning making only to words, then this ignores, in his terms, vast stretches of the landscape of human meaning making. We might, when we think about the study of religion, or certainly even more broadly, the study of culture, when we think about that, we cannot imagine anything perhaps more richly textured than the landscape that is a part of the actual living of religion and culture. Such things as art, music, architecture, ritual, pilgrimage, landscape, colors, mountains, trees, dancing, dramatic performances, praying, gesturing, clothing and vestments, hairstyles, eating, drinking, animals, fasting, killing, birthing, initiating, dying, marrying, nurturing, loving, the laying on of hands, circumcision, tooth extraction, menstruation, subincision, singing. Well, I think you get the point. There's really no end to this list. Yet all of these are things that we would find very, very difficult to capture adequately in terms of word and word meaning. So Mark Johnson offers something quite significant for us to consider. Virtually every religious human being who has ever lived did not traffic in written words of any kind, including scriptures. In his or her understanding of religion, and most certainly, these people did not engage in any level of intellectual religious discourse. For almost all religious people throughout all of history, the meaning of their religions has been felt, experienced, that something they enacted, something they practiced, it was grounded basically in their bodies. That religions are embodied is not the condition of some prior era, some primitive state of religion that has now been surpassed with the expanding of literacy. Rather, it's something that has been characteristic of all religious human beings. I well remember that when I went home as a graduate student at the University of Chicago and visited with my parents, who were farm people from Kansas, how shocked they were and simply looked at me in disbelief when I attempted to talk to them about these high concepts, theories, ideas, writers, and thinkers that I was so excited about in my graduate studies. I also recall that my father-in-law, a solid church-going man, told me quite frankly one day that he noticed that I had lost my religiousness when I began the study of religions. I think he was right in some respects. Thus, the object of the study we call religions scarcely corresponds at all with the religious lives of almost all religious peoples. We actually study texts in the study of religion, and these are considered often to be maps that trace the territories of the actual religious people. Scholar Jonathan Smith at the University of Chicago made this abundantly clear in his discussion of map and territory. He described it this way. He said that we suppose there are territories of real people and their religions, yet in the study of religion, maps are all we have. That means that we look to the texts, to the maps, and we restrict our study to that. These are religions disembodied. They allow us in true ideal form of Western academic objectives to be able to propose that what we're learning is objective, that we focus on the conceptual, that our studies of religion reflect what is propositional and theoretical, and that all of this is established, this is directed towards the establishment of truths and knowledge. Such meanings and types of meanings are produced by the mind, produced by the powers of great minds, and typically the study of religion has been a history of the study of the words of great thinkers, of great minds. This privileges the mind, the soul, the transcendent spirit, while ignoring the bodily and experiential aspect of religion which has shaped the religious lives of almost all religious people. Now, my academic colleagues would likely find my remarks perhaps a bit outrageous. They could probably offer, as I myself could, numerous examples of more embodied studies of religions, such as recent increases in field research, in requiring in courses site visits of students, and the more recent interest in what we call lived religions or religions on the ground. Mark Johnson's focus is on meaning and meaning making. The heart of his proposal is that while we are conditioned to understanding meaning rather exclusively in terms of concepts and propositions that are expressible and enactable as words, there is another whole realm of meaning-making that occurs more or less outside of our consciousness. This is meaning that is associated with the body, and he describes these body meanings as qualities, images, but not necessarily visual or conscious mental images, as patterns, as sensory motor processes, and as emotions. These kinds of meanings are constructed through our life experience. They become embedded in our bodies in terms of body schemas that are foundational, in his argument, to everything that exists at all levels of meaning. So we have then these body schematic meanings that are based in body experience and in body movement, based on experience, based on values that are attributed to these schemas over time. And we also then have the conscious notions of concepts and propositions. We may, in the past, have been able to say that there is value to these body schemas as being perhaps something meaningful or meaning-like. Yet, these are usually set aside as of another order, thus paralleling the divide between mind and body. And typically in academic studies, as we all know, we are often warned against allowing these body schemas to inform our own scholarship because they're considered to be subjective and perhaps irrational. Johnson invokes a principle that was presented by John Dewey, and this is the principle of continuity, and that is a principle that holds that these two levels or domains of meaning cannot be separate and unrelated. Rather, that concepts and propositions are built on these body schemas, and that it is impossible to actually have meaning at that level without them. So there is a correlation, an alliance between these unstatable, unspeakable meanings that are at the body basis, the body schemas, and the meanings that are presented in terms of propositions and concepts. Much of his book is based on showing how these body schemas can be formed, as well as to show how forms of meaning that are propositions and concepts are in fact deeply and unsurmountably based in these concepts. Now, Johnson, along with George Lakoff, is a great student of metaphor, and I noticed in his discussion of this an interesting use of metaphor that has some implications I'd like to develop for you. He understands the type of meaning making that is body-based. He describes that as lower than the higher meaning making that we are more accustomed to. I simply would like to note that this low-high metaphor, which he and George Lakoff would have a field day working through, seems to reflect a number of associations. One is the association of the head with conceptual meaning, while the grosser below-the-neck body is associated traditionally with the lower, the more animal senses, and that it is at this location in the grosser body where the sensory motor schemas tend to operate. So up is better, head is higher in a physical sense, and the gross body is below the head, so that there is a value that I think that he has associated with that. This suggests then, of course, that conceptual language-based meaning is more important, more advanced than body meaning. Yet, clearly, Johnson also sees the lower in the positive terms of foundational for and prior to conceptual meaning. And this is a part of the higher-lower metaphor as well. So if it's lower, it may be understood as more foundational. So this is an application of Johnson and Lakoff's discussion of metaphor to Johnson's own work here. Well, an important question that we need to address is, if we were to attempt to value and take into account the body schemas that are underlying the meaning-making that occurs even at the propositional and conceptual level, then how do we find and document these meanings, since they don't seem to be graspable in terms of words? And furthermore, why is it so difficult to be aware of these meanings being in existence? Well, I certainly think there are ways in which we can make ourselves more aware of them. Yet, Johnson does show that the human body tends, by its own structure and methods, to hide from our awareness of it. And this is simply the notion that we live as bodied minds. Since our bodies aren't normally the object of our attention, we relate to the world beyond our bodies as body minds, so that our body minds are directed towards our living in the world and not directed towards perceiving and understanding and being aware of ourselves. So that this is similar to the notion that we don't see our seeing, we don't hear our hearing, we don't taste our tasting. So it seems then relatively clear to follow from that, that we have little access to the world or ourselves as anything but body minds. So that it takes a little more trickery to try to understand how we can express these body schemas. It's not impossible to do so, however, and perhaps an analysis, a self-analysis, would be a way of attempting to understand that. A question that to lead up to that is, how do these schemas get formed? And here, Johnson suggests that the formation of these patterns, images, schemas, sensory motor processes are a matter of fundamental human life that is based in our movement. He invokes a scholar of movement, Maxine Sheets Johnstone, and he cites passage of Johnstone in his book. Let me read that for you. "We literally," Johnstone says, "discover ourselves in movement. We make sense of ourselves in the course of movement." So that's her statement. Now, what that means is then our patterns of movement, many are basic to simply being human beings, that we are upright, that we walk, that we have a front, that we have a back, that we experience gravity, that we have articulate arms, that we have opposable thumbs. All of these things are fundamental in the universal sense of establishing a body schema that deeply shapes our world and certainly every aspect of the propositions and concepts that we consider meaning. But these can also be understood in terms of the everyday patterns, the quotidian patterns of particular cultures or lifestyles. So that in applying to ourselves then this process, we might simply say, what are the movement patterns that allow an academic lifestyle to construct this style? And how do they then reflect the way we then understand the world? Well, certainly we might identify, and without much debate, that the academic lifestyle is a lifestyle of very little bodily movement, very little bodily awareness. We disable our bodies typically in order to learn. We focus almost exclusively on acts of the of vision and of hearing, and now on fingertip mouse clicking, and the rest of the body is rendered relatively inarticulate. So that we might ask, what sort of body schemas then would be constructed, and how might those body schemas be reflected in the very way that we understand our subjects? So that it seems to be, to me, to be no accident that the academic lifestyle is one that constructs an understanding of human beings as relatively disembodied, as focused primarily on words that are spoken or heard or read, and that this lifestyle then corresponds very closely with the way that we have restricted our subjects to being presented to us, meaningful and intelligible to us, only in terms of the words that they utter, the words that they write, and our analysis of those words in our thoughts and our minds. If we take seriously what Mark Johnson is telling us, we face significant challenge, and I think it's a creative challenge. Johnson's proposition is that there is meaning-making at the subconscious body level. He uses Dewey's proposition of continuity to suggest that even proposition and conceptual knowledge is based on this and inseparable from it. Therefore, if we were to embrace this idea, and I think we absolutely must, then we face a sort of revolutionary challenge to our academic studies of religion and culture, and certainly far beyond. The challenge, of course, is first that we can no longer ignore as separate and to be dismissed these body-based schemas of meaning, these patterns and images that are fundamental to making and supporting the meanings that are expressible in terms of words and concepts. So we then have multiple fronts on which we must address this challenge. One is we will certainly need to extend the scope of our studies beyond texts. So we need to look at acts, at performance theories. We need to expand our area of resources well beyond words and texts. This is a great challenge. It's going to be very difficult for us to do that. And yet, throughout this series of talks, I will discuss many, many, many possibilities of ways that we might begin to initiate that. Secondly, we need to really reshape our understanding of meaning, that instead of simply an objectivist, truth-based meaning that is separate from subjectivity, from feeling, from emotion, from these body-based informances, then we must revision our understanding of meaning so that we incorporate and include these without actually making them into pure subjectivity or pure whim. To understand that emotion, image, sensory motor patterns are fundamental, and for us to reinvent and to understand how we may incorporate those into our discussion of meaning and into our discussion of subject. We will also, I think, have to reinvent ourselves. We can no longer be people of a sedentary lifestyle, simply disembodying ourselves, because those sensory motor patterns will constrict the way we understand our subject matter. So there are new and daunting challenges that are fundamental to the next era of the study of religion and culture and to perhaps the academy very broadly. Throughout this series of talks, we will deal with many elements of these issues in some detail, offering a lot of suggestions and possibilities and some exciting new challenges. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.